You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We're here. My name is Jonathan Pollack. I'm a senior fellow and acting director in the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings. And we are here, of course, to mark the publication of the latest Thornton Center monograph by my colleague Cheng Li. But we're going to have a full program this afternoon that I think really is going to be most exciting in terms of an issue that, in my view, has not had the visibility, if you will, certainly in the United States, that it ought to have. But because of this publication and because of the others who are present here, we're going to be able to have exactly that kind of a conversation this afternoon. I think that the issue of tobacco, if we can just call it that for the moment, really captures, as few issues do, some of the daunting challenges that are not only there for the health and societal well-being of China, but, of course, for the entire population of China. The monograph highlights so many of these issues. It's really not only about the use of tobacco, but the place of tobacco in the Chinese economy as a whole, including, of course, in a few select provinces where it is very, very dominant. And then, of course, the effects of tobacco use that will be highlighted and what can be done about it. Now, all numbers in China, we know, are very, very big. But as I think some of the presentations will make very clear, the numbers here truly are staggeringly large. And the implications of them, of course, are equally large. And without – I won't steal the thunder of the speakers and the briefers, so they will discuss some of those numbers in the future. To me, though, if I could add something that isn't explicitly on the agenda, but I think in some sense belongs, is the question of whether or what lessons learned there might be from the experience of the United States and other advanced industrial economies in curtailing tobacco use, some of us here today, a few of us, me at least, I'm old enough to remember the first Surgeon General's report, which was in 1964. It was featured a major national television broadcast. It was greeted with something between skepticism and derision. But as Cheng notes in the study, in 1965, 52% of American males were smokers. And in 2009, 23.5 million are smokers. Now, what that tells you is that great progress has been made, but this is A, a very long-term campaign, and B, it's not really over. But there may be some important issues here that I think belong on a U.S.-China agenda in a way to sort of ask ways in which this kind of an issue, not, if you will, not a traditional security issue in any sense of the term, but very much an issue that affects the well-being of the people of China and has implications, of course, on a larger context as well, really warrant serious consideration. This afternoon, we'll really be looking, as I would see it, at about three or four different levels. And, of course, the speakers will go into this in much more detail. But just for your own awareness, the first big issue, it seems to me, is what I'll call a structural issue. The dependence on tobacco in China for employment, for profit, for tax revenues, all of this makes it very, very deeply embedded, not only at a bureaucratic level, but at a broader economic level, the role of the state monopoly on control of tobacco. So even if we think of tobacco use as addictive behavior, in a way, ironically, the reliance on tobacco for all of these purposes is also a form of addictive behavior. It's simply too many constituencies are beneficiaries, directly or indirectly, from the money that is generated by such use. The second level will be much more political, but both top-down and bottom-up. And I'm very glad to see that Cheng in the study really tries to address both issues. There's the issue at the leadership level of how important is this question to the leaders of China? How much are they identified with and truly committed to the issue of curtailing tobacco use and presumably at some point trying to limit tobacco production or turning the different tobacco industries to other kinds of more productive pursuits, if that is possible. Is it possible to somehow reconcile the profound contradictions, it seems to me, that exist in this area between the centrality of tobacco in the economy of China, but recognizing the consequences that are so decidedly negative for the health and well-being of China's citizens? The bottom-up issue, it seems to me, is at least as important, and that reflects, in effect, the demands that are coming from within Chinese society. We see this in a whole range of areas now, expectations of clean air, clean water, safe food, environmental protection. All are fundamentally, if you will, quality of life issues that many Chinese citizens are asking themselves. And the question is whether they will have the power and the capacity and the determination to do something about it. This, in effect, goes well beyond just the tobacco issue per se. And then last, and certainly by no means least, is the human side of this story that really needs to be addressed. Issues of public health in China are now critical. The true costs here of the reliance on tobacco and the utilization of tobacco are pervasive and they are cumulative. And again, these will be discussed in the briefings, so I don't want to take them on right now. Will the leaders of China in this context truly have the courage and the determination to tackle these issues in a central way? And if they do not, what might be the longer-term consequences? This is something that I think we all ought to be asking ourselves today. Before turning over the program to the moderator and the individual speakers, let me just note that simultaneous interpretation is available, but we would just simply ask that at the end of the event, you should, of course, return the receivers. Don't walk out of the room without them. It would cost us a lot. And of course, I should also add that the video and materials and transcript of what transpires this afternoon will be available on the Brookings website and on the Thornton Center website, hopefully by the end of next week. So without further ado, let me welcome all of you again, and let me welcome the speakers and moderator to come to the stage.
Thank you.
Okay, sure, Jim.
The speakers probably will come later on because we will use a screen. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for that very comprehensive, insightful remarks. I also want to join Jonathan in welcoming you all, particularly send my appreciation for those who travel from far, Dr. Yang from Beijing, and really come here for this program, and also Sarah England and my good friend Wang Yanzhong, and also from the other cities. Now, any major study of China requires intellectual collaboration. It is particularly true for this case because the public health issues is the area that relatively new for me, despite the fact that I received, you know, early medical training in my early career. And because of time, I will not be able to acknowledge, you know, institutions and individuals on the both sides of the Pacific really helped me tremendously. But my appreciation is profound. Now, my topic is China's growing tobacco epidemic, political mapping, and anti-smoking strategy. I will cover three major areas. One is China's tobacco epidemic, a smoking dragon. This is a term some critics use in both China and overseas. It is a harsh term, but it sends a very clear message. Despite the economic growth over the past three decades, really quite a remarkable achievement, China's public health actually has a lot of problems. I think the other panelists also will shed light on that. Second, I also want to explain the really remarkable achievements or progress on the part of the anti-smoking campaign and their perspective how to further develop in on this very important course. And thirdly, I will highlight the findings of my research about the political mapping and also how to develop a sound strategy for this very important task. Now, before discussing these three things, I will first start to share with you my main arguments about this research. The first is the high prevalence of tobacco use in China is China's single most serious public health problem. Borrowing my friend Huan Gang, a professor at Tsinghua University, he actually is also delegate of the 18th Party Congress. He said this high preference of tobacco use is the largest man-made calamity of the 21st century China. Very, very powerful statement from intellectual within the system. Secondly, the widespread tobacco use occurs in the context of a complex web of political power, commercial incentives, state industrial proximity, regional interests, and to a certain extent, cultural norms, as Jonathan also highlighted earlier. It's a very complicated issues involved for many stakeholders and many dimensions of the China's political and social life, economic life. Thirdly, the international campaign to control tobacco cannot claim any true breakthrough without fundamental progress in China. Now, also, the Chinese anti-smoking campaign has the potential to change the course of the global epidemic, both nationally and globally. I think that the next few years will be really a major test whether China will make that bold step and therefore change the landscape. I think it's a very, very important issue in our time. And finally, because tobacco governance is a multi-level task that involves the top leadership, the campaign need engage in strategic political mapping, how to approach the top leadership, how to make sure they will be on the part of the campaign rather than block for some economic reasons or some representative vested interests and et cetera. Now, these are the key arguments of my report. Now, let me first start with the first issue, the smoking dragon. Now, this is evident in the three areas. First, China is the world's biggest tobacco producer. I will give you the detailed information, the statistics. Second, China is has the largest pool of cigarette consumers. And the third, probably most disturbingly, China is the gravest victim of the smoking-related health crisis. Now let's look at some of the astonishing statistics. First, China's total production of cigarettes accounted for 40%. This is updated statistics of the world's total, about four times than the United States, which is the second largest tobacco-producing country, four times than the United States. Second, China's 300 million smokers is really one quarter of the world's smokers and the consumer a third of world's cigarettes. Thirdly, China's smoking penetration rate was about 5% higher. It's 28.7% than the global average. Was about 24% in the year 2009 and 2010. Thirdly, tobacco-related disease caused 1.2 million deaths every year and accounting for 12% of total deaths in China. And finally, total smoking-related deaths are expected to increase further. In basically 8 years will be 2 million per year if there's no drastic change in terms of policies to stop this kind of epidemic. And with half of the victims being, die between the age of 35 and 64 years old. Astonishing statistics produced by China's researchers and medical professions, and China's public health ministry acknowledges these numbers. Now, let me share with you some of the charts. This is the China's total cigarettes revenue from 1990 to 2005. I think Dr. Yang probably have updated statistics. You see the revenue increase significantly. It's about, in 2005, it's 240 billion Chinese yuan. Now, this is the cigarette production. And also, this is from the early years, from 1952 until 2009. You see that's a very clear increase. In many countries, particularly in the West, United States, UK, and some of the European countries, and also China's East Asian neighboring countries, actually you see the decline. But in China, continue to grow in such kind of astonishing speed. Now, this is the study conducted by the WHO. It's about the top 10 risk factors for mortality in China in 2000. You see that active smoking is the second line, is already the second largest cause for mortality. Among the male population, it's the largest one. But this does not include some of the disease, some of the problem like the high blood pressure, as we know, related with smoking. So the real number is really very, very big. Now, this is the Xinhua News, Chinese official media, has that cartoon, tells us that the smoking dragon, this phenomenon, is really quite powerful. The largest public health crisis in the making. This is by Xinhua News. I really applaud Chinese journalists and official media for taking this kind of very important positive approach towards this epidemic. Now, this is a photo I took last year when I visited Yunnan, Yuxi. This is all in Yuxi. You can see it's a different picture. And this is one of the largest factories in China, tobacco factories. It's the outside scenes. Now, I did not get a chance to visit the inside, but that I got from Xinhua News also as well. This is the inside. It's a very modern, very impressive, you know, factory. It's probably the state of art from this perspective in producing cigarettes. Now, this is the chart about the Yuxi brand. And in Yunnan, about 1 hour or 2 hours from Kunming, you see this is only within 10 years, you see that kind of dramatic change, increase about the cigarette sales in this particular factory. Now, let me move to the second part of my presentation. It's about the campaign. Let me mention a few things in terms of breakthrough or progress. One important landmark event, actually, related with Chinese government. Chinese government signed the FCTC in 2005, actually signed 2003, ratified 2005. It's really legitimizing the tobacco control movement. Government acknowledged it, and therefore really opened the door for all these grassroots campaign as well. So we should give some credit for Chinese government did that. Now, but at the same time, also that last year, for the first time in the China's five-year plans, had a clear statement that a resolution calling for the full implementation of a smoking ban in public places. This is adopted last March and the 2011, really pushed by medical professions and the anti-tobacco movement. And thirdly, never in the six-decade history of the PRC has the public been so aware of the negative impact of smoking on health as they have been in recent years. Now, this is largely due to the impact of bottom-up, it's very much a bottom-up anti-smoking campaign led by NGOs. And I also particularly want to mention Professor Yang Gonghuan. And in China, she and the other two, legal professions happen to be, all women. They have a nickname called Three Old Ladies. Of course, in China, really quite young, not really old, but it's a respect. Three Old Ladies. are changing the course of the history in China. They aggressively in the past 20 years, along with Professor Yang Gonghuan, the other is Hu, the other two are Wu Yiqun and Xu Guanhua, right? They all work very closely in the CDC and also in anti-tobacco campaign. And we're so fortunate to have Professor Yang with us. Now, they also, really develop a broad coalition, which particularly as I described in the report, it's the landmark report 2011 by Yang Gonghuan, also aforementioned scholar Huan Gang. He is a delegate for the 18th Party Congress. They wrote that fascinating report, even gave the bad score for the Chinese government. Out of 100 points, Chinese government was graded with 37.5 grade. It's a failing grade, right? So that's the background, really wonderful campaign. Now, the issue is not just about the public health crisis. I can highlight five areas beyond the public health crisis. The first, economically detrimental. China's health expenditures tripled between 2000 and 2009. In 2005, the financial burden, according to professor of economics at Beida, Li Ling, that the burden of smoking was 253 billion versus the revenue, as earlier mentioned, from tobacco is 240 billion. So it's not worthwhile even economically compared with the medical expenditure, right? Secondly, that the socially destabilizing because most smokers actually from the poor sector of the population. And they really need to pay very high bill for public health. And also, as we know, that the share of health costs paid out of pocket by individual in China is much, much higher than many other countries, particularly with developed countries. So this could be a social problem, into social unrest, that how to cover this kind of increasing medical expenditure. The third is demographically devastating. This is a quote from one report released a few years ago saying, one third of all Chinese men now aged 29 or younger will end up dying prematurely from tobacco-related disease. Astonishing statistics. I do not know how, serious, how reliable scientifically, but that report caught my attention. I mean, you really cannot find a more serious challenge like this one, if it's true. Now, thirdly, it's internationally damaging. China's failure to fulfill its commitment to the FCTC, that treaty, will stand in sharp contrast to countries that have made impressive progress in tobacco control. Not just the Western countries like UK and Sweden and the United States, but many other countries. Now, I think Russia and India are also catching up in this area, right? Now, my friend Wang Yanzhong used a very astonishing word. I will let him to say, to refer to China. Again, the sick man of Asia is really still with China, in this kind of health epidemic. It's really a wake-up call, despite all this impressive progress in virtually every area, but in public health, facing daunting uphill challenge. Right. Now, finally, it's a political unpopular for the leaders, because tobacco governance and the public health security have become issues of the utmost sensitivity related with corruption. Now, I want to share with you two things. One is the Li Wei, famous woman in China. This is the magazine, it's a leading journal in China called Caijing Magazine. In the issue of February 14 last year, used a title called Shared Mistress. She slept with 15 senior leaders, ministers or above. She is a tobacco lady, started her career in tobacco industry in Yunnan. It's really quite a nasty story. Chinese media reported 15 leaders, ministers, deputy minister, provincial governors. Now, I want to share with you some of them. One is the governor of Yunnan, Li Jiating. He now was sentenced for suspended death penalty, will be in jail for the rest of his life. for corruption. Most of the corruption related with tobacco industry. The second person is Chen Tonghai, former Sinopec CEO, one of the largest, probably the largest oil company in the world. Also, same sentence, suspend death penalty. Start with the affair, you know, related with Li Wei, the woman we just saw. Of course, the story has some sexism or even racism because she had come from, immigrant from Vietnam, has some of the, you know, her father maybe a fourth from French descendant, whatever. But that's a different story. Now, Du Shicheng, former Qingdao Party Secretary, life imprisonment. Another person, Beijing Vice Mayor. They all had affair with Li Wei. Now, but interesting enough, Li Wei is free. According to a delegate in the National People's Congress, they said she lives in Hong Kong with 1 billion Chinese Hong Kong dollars in her bank account, free. But some of her clients are in jail for life. You know, this is just a story I still do not know, you know, what's going on. Now, let's move to the final point. I for time concern, I want to finish in time, right? Stop. I have 10 minutes. Okay, thank you. So I will leave some, you know, things for my colleagues. 7 minutes. Thank you. Now, it's the most important issue, I think, in my presentation is the four levels that you will see the details in the report. Because it's so complicated issue, we need to approach, you know, from different levels. First, from top national leadership. This is the topic I will cover. I will not cover the other three things, but very quickly, just mention the other three levels. One is the central government agencies. It's fascinating to know that the regulator of the tobacco industry in China is also its operator. Borrowing my friend, you know, Bloomberg News, Michael Fauci, he said that just similar, like it is like the FDA being run by executives of Philip Morris. But this is exactly what happened in China. The controller and the operator is the same institution, same person. So that tells you why all these things, you know, completely out of control. It's conflict of interest, right? Now, Yunnan is the largest province in terms of production and also farming of the tobacco leaves, and also the Hongtao Yuxi. I show you some of our photo early on. I did some case study. Look at the details because we do need to have a clear sense what's going on, how they interact with each other. Then we can have a better strategy to deal with these challenges. Now, this is the in terms of interagency coordination mechanism. At the head of that institution is the Ministry of Industrial and Information Technology, then followed by the two major ministries, Minister of Health and Ministry of Foreign Affairs, because they coordinated the treaties. Right? And then by five institutions, like the Ministry of Finance and the State Tobacco Monopoly Bureau Administration, and et cetera. These are the government institution, the second level. I do not want to talk about details. Now, this is I develop a kind of mapping just only in terms how to deal with each issue areas, like political commitment, we should focus on what? Tobacco control and anti-smoking legislation with the National People's Congress and the details. This is all in the report. I don't want to go detail. But this is in terms of hierarchical things, because China's state tobacco monopoly administration really it's like a pyramid, you know, from the top level to second tier provincial level and the third tier, the prefecture municipal level, they all have the bureaus and the grassroots is about 1800 bureaus. So that's structurally, it's a very, very powerful institution, right? So I think the reform is much needed to how to deal with this kind of institutional framework. Now, let me talk about the first one, the only thing I want to talk about, the top leadership. Let me review the generational change of the Chinese leadership. The first is Mao Zedong and the smoking. Chairman Mao is famous for, you know, smoking pictures. This is during the Cultural Revolution. Everyone in China, everywhere in China, sees these kind of pictures. You know, Mao with cigarette, manhood, you know, power, you know, all this kind of image, right? Now, this is more recent things by, I do not know the author, just I saw in online. In China, there's no credit can be given because I don't know who did that picture. See the continuing influence of this first generation. Now, second generation is by Deng Xiaoping. You can also see he is quite famous. for smoking. He even sometimes told Western journalists, he said, my wife doesn't, this is a direct quote, he said, my wife does not smoke. I smoke, but my wife is, you know, her health is much poorer than me. You know, this is kind of a really, the message is quite astonishing, but that's widely known in China. And the third generation is really different. Zhang Zemin never smokes, or at least as far as I know that he does not smoke. And he actually, under his tenure, China was the host of the 10th World Conference on Tobacco or Health in 1997. He gave an opening remark. So that's a very positive development. Now, the fourth generation, the current leaders, this is I spent a lot of time doing research, is the top nine leaders. That none of them smokes now. It's wonderful news. But I'm afraid it will change with the next probably standing committee. We know some of the candidates are famous also, you know, for their habit of smoke. Now, this is power bureaus, next tier. I still, in certain cases, I'm still not entirely sure. I got the conflicting information, so I put a question mark. If you know the answer, let me know. Yeah. Now, this is it's quite remarkable. Majority of them do not smoke. So, of course, I can't go details, but this is the change of the, at least the current leaders never smoke publicly. That itself is a big progress. Now, but at the same time, from time to time, they still visit companies. This is the Hongtao company. Top leaders visited. I have the detailed record about their visit to these companies. But you do see, since China signed that treaty, they become less and less likely to visit these tobacco companies. Now, this is a newly built museum in Shanghai. It's quite impressive. I mean, advocating, actually, smoking and et cetera. Now, this is some of the senior leaders of the Tobacco Bureau. They are well-connected into a political echelon and et cetera. Now, this is fascinating. This is just a few months ago, soon-to-be first lady, wife of Xi Jinping, appear on the national TV and the national media, along with Bill Gates, to talk about no tolerance for secondhand smoking. She really emerged as a wonderful first lady, soon to be first lady, to have the right courses, you know, in terms of AIDS control, TB, and also no smoking. I think it's a wonderful development. This is another very nice photo. This will give you kind of hope and encouragement. Now, conclusion. For the Chinese leadership to reverse this ongoing catastrophic health crisis, to save millions of lives, especially children's lives, is not a policy debate, but a moral obligation and a social political imperative. And also, time will tell us whether, you know, the tobacco control be one of the top priorities for the upcoming Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang administration. And thank you very much for not smoking. Thank you. Thank you. So, Dr. Yang. We probably need some help. Yeah, thank you.
今天有翻译，所以我说中文。我想我演讲的题目是在李教授发表这本书的时候，我想跟大家更详细的来介绍一下中国的控烟的情况。那么我想讲到的是四个问题。第一个，这是在中国的这种控烟的这种背景。 第二，那么控烟的这个问题实际上是在检视着中国领导人的发展观。第三呢，我想讲一讲中国的控烟形势，最后我们得到什么样的结论。大家都知道，中国在过去30年内，它的经济发展是令世界瞩目。但是在这个经济快速发展的同时， 中国人的健康状况并没有像经济发展那样有所改变，就是有快速的改变。 那么甚至于在上世纪八九十年代的时候，中国人的健康状况甚至于是非常缓慢，而且是低于了周边很多发展中国家。那么被世界卫生发展指标来评判，中国人实际上并不像他的经济发展一样是排在了，在2010年的人类发展指标中是排在了第89位。而中国人的健康期望寿命在20个国家中， G20 这种国家中也是排在了后边的几位。那么这样的一个状况实际上是折射出来了在过去中国在看中国的领导，中国政府首先他的注意力是在关注到了中国的是经济发展，而不是是以最高的就是人民的健康作为主要的目标。那么在中国的控烟状况，那么在两年前，也就是中国烟草控制框架公约履行五周年的时候，我们对中国的控烟形势做了一个评判，那么用了几个数字来描述它。正如刚刚李教授提到的，中国是一个烟农和 struggle， 那么实际上有三亿吸烟者，有 7.4 亿的二手不吸烟者暴露于吸烟，还有每年有100多万的人死于和烟草相关的疾病。那么和烟的这个经济的利益相比，从它的税收和因为吸烟所导致的医疗费用损失和劳动力的损失，实际上已经是一个负数。再加上中国虽然有3亿吸烟者，有 1.5 亿的吸烟者每天吸的烟是人民币5块钱以下的这个吸这个一包的这个卷烟。那么实际上也就是说，在中国烟仍然是非常便宜。这也就是刚刚李教授提到的，那么在这五周年的时候，60多个中外专家联合对中国的履约的绩效给了一个评分，是在37.3分。那么这 37.3 分包括哪些信息呢？也就是说我们说这个中国的这种控烟，也就是说在这样的一个背景下，我们说中国的控烟实际上它是不是一个简单的公共卫生问题，它实际上包含了非常多的这样的重要的信息。我们说中国的这种控烟，它不仅仅是一个简单的公共卫生问题，实际上在控烟的这个问题上的处置反映了中国领导人的发展观。那么它是不是能够有效的能够控制烟草控制，那么也是和它以后能不能够很好的来把握中国的处置很多政治问题相关联的。而且特别是如果能够处置的好的话，那么中国的未来就像我们刚刚提到的，你的健康的问题有可能会改变，但是如果处置的不好的话，这样的健康问题反而会导致更会与其他国家的这个健康水平有很大的差距。那么我们说的第一点，为什么说烟草控制的问题是能够检验中国领导层的它的发展观？首先我们说在2003年的时候，大家都知道是我们上一届的，就是这个领导人上任的前十年。那么上任以后，实际上 SARS 的流行实际上是有一个非常大的导致了大家都在反思这个问题，认为中国实际上 SARS 为什么是在中国流行长达半年而不能够有效控制，而且从中国向全世界去蔓延。那么其中一个很大的问题，实际上中国的这个在过去在03年之前，在上世纪90年代80年代，那么是由于对卫生的忽略，因此导致了整个公共卫生状况的衰落，那么实际上不能够有效的来控制它。 那么这样的一个状况，我们说如果说是在 SARS 的时候过后，大家一个很明显的反思就是说人的健康是高于我们的经济发展。因为在那个时候胡锦涛主席说了一句话，说中国人民的健康是最高的，那么我们在那之后应该能够反思，应该是把我们人民的健康放在更高的位置上。那么这么样的一个状况，那么决定了中国在03年的时候实际上是非常积极的批准了烟草控制框架公约。那么这个其实是可以说明中国政府在高层的态度，一般来说他应该是还是把公共卫生有所看重，人民的健康的状况有所看重。但是反过来说，但是从批准公约以后，公约在中国生效以后的这37.3分的这个答卷，实际上也表明了要彻底的改变中国领导层、中国政府的这种经济第一、健康第二的这种观念，也不是那么轻而易举的能够改变。那么我们看到的这些事实，这37.3分的这个事实是怎么来的呢？大家可以看到，首先我们看到在保护人们免受二手烟危害的时候，那么这样的调查结果告诉你，过去30天有 72.7% 的人们都报告在他所工作观察的公共场所是有人吸烟的，有 63.3% 的人是看到在自己的室内工作场所是有人吸烟的。那么这份成绩大家可以看到，那么在这个方面，在我们过去五年中它的执行显然是不容乐观。当然更详细的情况我就不再讲，像包括在餐馆里边，那是 89% 的餐馆是人吸烟，包括在家里边以及在政府的办公楼是 58% 等等。那么从第二点，我们说第二个策略包括提供戒烟帮助来说，那么这些吸烟的人其实他到访问吸烟者去看医生的时候，那么只有1/3的人得到了医生问他你是不是吸烟，劝其他戒烟。那么也就是说2/3的吸烟者到医院里边去，医生也对他的吸烟状况是不闻不问。那么实际上这些想戒烟的人可以 92% 的人说我没有得到任何来帮助，所以中国的吸烟者的服习是非常高的基本上。那么第三点，我们说中国的这个烟盒上的健康警语，那么 40% 的人他实际上他都没有得到这种鼓励说他是不是考虑戒烟，这是第二点。第三，我们说关于烟盒上的这个健康警语，大家看到这是中国现在上边的烟盒的警语，那么这种警语上都是每一条都是不符合框架公约的要求的。首先这个焦油的含量用这么大的字显示出来，实际上是告诉他是一种误导。那么同时呢，用这样的宣传话告诉你那个焦油含量更低，那么意味着有更多的关爱。那么这是在中国现在的烟盒上仍然是这种情况。大家看到所有的这些中南海、长白山以及其他的烟盒都是用这么大的字在显示告诉你它的烟盒它是很低的。那么这样的成绩我们也可以说，实际上这样的一个状况你可以知道，这是第三个方面中国的控烟的策略执行的情况。那么这样的情况结果是大量的中国人都以为吸低的焦油的烟它的危害就更少，而且这个数据调查数据更奇怪的告诉你，实际上在医生中间也就是红色的这个幅度这一块，那么更多的医生、更多高教育程度的人他都认同这个错误观念。文化程度低的人他多数是不知道，但是有这个错误观念的人在中国居然是文化程度高的人，医生、老师这样的行业的人错误认识比重更大。 为什么？我想这就是我们的媒体，主流的媒体，那么被烟草公司忽悠以后，做了这样的错误宣传，所以才是文化程度越高的人，错误认识比例越高。那么包括像现在在这个受到广告宣传的比例中间，那么大家可以看到实际上将近 20% 的人，那么跟全世界其他国家相比也是算比例高的，那么他都是看到烟草的广告促销。那么在特别是在男性，年轻男性中，这个比例达到了 40%。刚刚说到这个烟盒，就是这个卷烟的这个价格，刚刚已经提到了，实际上有一半的吸烟者都是吸的5块钱以下的烟。那么这样的一个执行的措施，大家都很清楚好还是不好，但是这是我们国家，就是刚刚李教授显示的，我们的烟草控制框架公约履行小组的工信部的部长，也就是说是负责整个履约的人。那么这个部长说的，我认为我们中国已经是按照公约的执行，是达到目标了的。那么这是他在两会上的报告说的话。然后第二呢，他还说呢，你们说要加税吗？加税实际上这个还需要实检的证明，我个人认为这个卷烟税在中国已经够高了。那么大家可以设想，我们刚刚用事实证明，实际上中国的卷烟税是非常低的，而且用这个事实 1.5 亿的吸烟者，一半的吸烟者吸的是5块钱一盒的烟，那么这个价格在中国是非常低的。但是呢，作为中国的领导人，他为什么会这样看呢？大家可以明白，实际上在这个工信部的部长的领导这个心里边，他还是认为烟草加税，烟草是能够挣来更多的税利。今年在中国是闹得最响的一件事情，就是所谓烟草院士。什么叫做烟草院士呢？就是指的是这个烟草业里边的一个研究人员，他因为号称他研究低焦油导致的低危害做出来的突出贡献，这个贡献呢就被中国的工程院选为了院士。那么这个院士实际上在中国实际上是最高的学术界的一个荣誉称号，当然不仅仅是荣誉称号呢，也有相当的利益保证，所以很多人都采取了在中国采取不正当的手段去获取它。当然首先它这个本身在世界上低焦是不是能减害本身就被证明是一个伪命题，而且呢在它的提名书里边很重要的说到的，它的贡献不是说减轻了多少健康危害，他是说由于他的贡献使烟草业挣得了这么多的钱，就是4860亿人民币，而且呢出口以后呢还挣得了2亿4300万美元的外汇。那么实际上他提到的他的贡献仍然是他的这个仍然是他的就是经济贡献。而且他不仅是这么说，他的院士是怎么样得到的呢？他是在工程院里边被环境和纺织部门的这些专家们来回顾他的成绩。而且这些人呢实际上没有受过任何医学和公共卫生的训练。而其中的一个院士说，我之所以投他的票，是因为我考虑到烟草业对中国的经济贡献很大，所以我就投了他作为院士。那么在中国实际上在这件事情上，可能是今年在中国的控烟界是讨论的批评的最多的一件事，其中包括100名院士写信要求重新对这个人的所谓贡献进行回顾。但是这件事情上过了半年，到现在仍然没有结果。那么事实上从这些事实中，从中国的领导人，从特别是中国的负责控烟的这种中高层的领导，以及中国的科学界， 那么看得出来，大家对烟草业是采取了包容态度，理由就在于它是有很大的经济的贡献。所以从这些事实上，我们觉得在中国真正要考虑到你是经济第一还是健康第一，实际上这个扭转还是非常困难的。大家看到这个，实际上就是刚刚得到的这些假的这些成绩，那么得到了国家科学技术进步奖。这幅图是在烟草公司五月城的烟草公司的网站上截下来的。那么实际上这些所谓的国家的这种奖，实际上已经是被烟草业拿来进行宣传。所以为什么那么多老百姓会被误导呢？它不是简单的烟草公司说有国家科技部的奖，有工程院的院士的抬头，那么这样的宣传是很容易让大家能够误导的。当然在中国，实际上现在我们说处于焦灼状态，就控烟和反控烟是一直是在不停就是斗争的非常激烈。那么从反控烟的角度上来说，首先在中国的这种反控烟的各种奇谈怪论在中国流行很多，那么我不想很详细的一条一条的来说，那么但是有几个很重要的观点，特别是烟草公在中间一直流行国际烟草控制框架公约，那么包括从国际法律专家都说中国的这个公约是具有低于宪法高于一切国内法的这样的一个权威，但是他们说这个法没有转化成国内法以后它很不能执行，特别是和公约配套的实施准则它是没有法律效力的。那么这种话在中国不断的被就是重复，让大家去抵消公约的效力，以及说卷烟吸烟是对人们的健康有危害，但是 99.4% 的烟气里边的成分对健康都是无害的，只有 0.6% 有害，其中只有 0.2% 会致癌症。那么这样讲的结果，最后当然大家觉得这个危害大概和什么一般的你在空气中间包括甚至于很多人说肺癌的元凶是什么，就是空气污染而不是吸烟等等等等。那么我想这些错误的观念在中国是流行很多，那么很多这些观念都是通过专卖局他们专门写了一本书叫做针对烟草控制框架公约的对策和对案，所以我们把它称为双对方案。那么这本书里边的很多政策都是被烟草专卖局去绑架了其他的政府部门作为中国的政府文件而来进行发布。当然在这样的一个情况下，他就不难理解他为什么产量一直是上升的。那么在今年的5月31号以心态健康发展中心还有其他中国预防医学会中国控烟协会联合发布的这个揭露中国烟草业的干扰中，概括出来了烟草业它实际上它的干扰中国的烟草控制的八宗罪。那么这些详细的情况大家可以去这个网上可以看到这个书。那么中国的这样的一些行业，包括它像通过蓝色风尚为爱起跑来进行大量的促销，以及在学校里边，但我想说到的这个100多所的烟草希望小学，那么当然也不是完全没有进步，这个其中有2所四川的烟草希望小学被四川工商局下令整改，所以已经把烟草希望小学的烟草去掉了，改名为爱心希望小学。那么在控烟方面当然有大量的工作做，那么这些工作当然包括从很早对烟草的流行进行监测和评价，特别是有大量的发表物，那么这些发表物实际上是对于揭露烟草公司对于促进中国的这个烟草控制是非常有好处的，当然也包括刚刚提到的在“十二五”规划上的这样的一些很大的进展。 以及中国的两会上很多很多的代表，人大的代表，政协的代表，关于烟草的这个提案。那么这些提案都是非常明确的，是针对烟草的控制，包括有很多这样的无烟奥运，以及多数的这种无烟的这种项目在中国，以及我们的法律专家们那么成立的控烟法学网，那么是在支持中国的控烟等等，以及像这样的一直从几年来都一直不断的在呼吁要把这个图形警示放上中国的烟盒。大家刚刚看到了中国现在的烟盒就是这样子，但是在民间包括媒体包括这样的展板宣传，包括在98年就开始的在网络上的呼吁，那么很多这种事是做了很多，也包括我们的地方政府。今年必须要提到的就是这个哈尔滨和天津这两个市，应该说是中国第一次有了两个地方法规，它是以中国以接近公约精神的这样的一个法规。这些都说明什么呢？在中国虽然有很强大的反控烟的力量，但是在这些工作也做得很多，虽然这些工作还没有到影响大局影响决策，但是我们说总是事情总是积少成多，慢慢的引起的，就像我们中国一句古话说的，不积跬步无以至千里，不积小流无以成江河。所以呢，我想这也是中国中控烟中间表现出来的进步力量。那么我们想说，最后根据这样的一个结论，就是中国所带来的控烟如果不控好，中国所带来的这个健康的这种危害，那么这是正如就是世界银行这个在慢病控制报告中间提到的，实际上中国现在有2亿6千万的慢性病的患者，而且呢这些中间如果说是花费了大量的医疗费用，如果在未来的烟草控制不成功的话，那么中国实际上未来由于大量的这种医疗费用的耗动和劳动力的损失，实际上是会有非常大的影响。那么这正是在我们这是在10年的两会特刊中就提到了。那么在这儿我们最后还是想说，我们在很快中国会有新一任的领导人，那么我们对新一代领导人来说，在控烟这个问题上，我们希望他能够在公开的场合下表态，说中国政府一定要善意履约，积极控烟，希望他制定一个非常完整的控烟的行动计划。到目前为止，中国的控烟规划还没出来，这是世界卫生组织要求的，实际上你批准履约开始就应该在1年之内出来，现在马上要7年了还没有出来，但是我们希望新一任的领导人能够按照公约的精神制定这个条款，然后呢能够很好的来控烟，这样才能使中国真正的成为未来的一个健康和谐的社会，也才会有更大的发展。谢谢大家。
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.I believe this is the first time for me to be at the Brookings to make such a presentation. Just now, Chen gave an excellent overview of the progress and the prospects of tobacco control in China, and Professor Yang actually focused on the issue of political development and basically gave another excellent presentation on how this issue of tobacco control actually reflects China's leaders' development concept. I'm going to focus on a different angle here by asking it's still going to be focused on political commitment, but my question will be slightly different. Basically, I'm going to ask, why is tobacco control not on the government decision agenda? today, given that all these problems, you know, harm, right, that the tobacco industry has done to the Chinese people. And we all know that China is a land of superlatives, right? It consumes the most concrete and steel, emits the most greenhouse gases, and, of course, to the chagrin of health specialists, it is the world's biggest tobacco producer, largest cigarette consumer, and arguably the gravest victim of the smoking-related health crisis, as quoted, I quoted that from Chen's report. Actually, in the words of the U.S. CDC director Tom Frieden, China has the biggest tobacco problem in the world. He said that when he was giving a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations a couple of months ago. So despite the seriousness of the problem, right, so far we still haven't seen any decisive government action on tobacco control in China. You know, by that, I mean the issue has not been up for an active authoritative decision by top leaders since the ratification of FCTC in 2005. And it is encouraging that tobacco control language was included in the government's five-year plan in March 2011, and the Ministry of Health acted to put an indoor smoking ban in place, but the ban has largely been disregarded, as we all know, right? And it appears also that the Minister of Health seems to be the only government agency seriously pushing for tobacco control. In other words, tobacco control has yet to be elevated from, quote-unquote, a specialized agenda, an agenda that is concerned by special government committees or functional bureaucracies, onto the so-called general decision agenda. Well, that is basically the list of the subjects within the government agenda that are up for an active authoritative decision. Well, we haven't seen that happening in China. Right? Actually, none of the top leaders so far have been publicly spoken out against tobacco use in China. Well, and that is in sharp contrast to their attitudes toward other health problems in China, such as HIV/AIDS. We know that every year Wen Jiabao is going to come out shaking hands with, you know, people living with HIV/AIDS. This is a very powerful message, loud, but we haven't seen that happen in the tobacco control field. Ironically, each year, 1.2 million Chinese die of smoke-related illness. That is more than the death from HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and traffic accidents combined. And the lack of action on the Chinese leaders is also in sharp contrast to other countries, right? Chen has mentioned India and Russia. Well, we know that India, even though it has 275 million people who use tobacco products, it has followed global trends in tobacco restrictions, you know, banning smoking in public places in 2008. And in 2009, it required graphic health warnings on cigarette packages. It has steadily raised taxes on tobacco products, you know, most recently by 20%. When I was in India early this year, I was told by a senior official of the Ministry of Health, he said very proudly, that we are in full compliance with FCTC. Right? Let's now look at Russia again. This happened most recently, we know that in Russia, close to one-third of the population smokes, right? But just 10 days ago, right, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev voiced support for a proposed ban on public smoking by 2015. I was very impressed when he said that the government is not at war with smokers, but we are making a stand against smoking. None of the Chinese leaders have made a stand against smoking. Even though, as Chen has said, all the Politburo Standing Committee members are non-smokers, but they haven't made a stand on this issue. Right? So why is that the case? I want to unravel this puzzle. I think it makes sense for us to examine the three streams and the Chinese policy dynamics, basically the problem streams, the policy streams, and the political streams. By problem streams, I mean how is that problem being recognized among the Chinese leaders? By politics, I mean, is the political climate right for effective government action? You know, by proposal streams, policy streams, I mean, is a politically acceptable and technically feasible solution available in China? So let's first look at the problem streams. The question is, how does a given condition, such as tobacco, the harm caused to tobacco use, get defined as a problem awaiting government action? The answer basically lies in both means by which policymakers learn about those conditions, or the ways in which conditions become defined as a problem. While scientific evidence and statistics, categorically point to the negative consequences of tobacco use in China, it is worth noting that, A, there is still a lack of consensus on the cost of tobacco use, even though Dr. Li has already invoked the research by Peking University, the Center for the Chinese Economy Studies. But even though the total economic cost of smoking was much higher than the fiscal revenue drawn from the tobacco industry, but still, many of those Chinese government officials, even Chinese leaders, they believe that the tobacco industry is good for Chinese economic growth, And actually they believe believe that it's crucial for Chinese economic growth, but this is already convincing enough to dissuade the Chinese leadership, whose legitimacy we know hinges upon economic growth, not to pursue a proactive policy on tobacco control. And B, unlike an acute outbreak event, like SARS in 2003, that can quickly raise the eyebrows of national leaders. Smoke-related illness and mortality is basically an attrition epidemic, or in the words of the Politburo member Wang Yang, it's like a frog in a pot of slow boiling water, Wenshui zhu qinghua, right? That is unlikely to generate immediate and strong esprit de corps among the key leaders and strengthen the state autonomy from the special interest in decision-making. Professor Dr. Li already in his book pointed out that leaders believe the health consequences of tobacco will take about 10 to 20 years to develop. That's actually the best example of what leaders actually think about this issue. And C, despite the profound social, political, and economic implications of China's tobacco epidemic, the issue has not been framed as a security problem, Unlike HIV/AIDS, which is already securitized and therefore successfully reclassified from a condition into a problem, we haven't seen that happening in the case of tobacco control. So this is the problem, the stream, we say, basically, the condition has not been classified as a problem here, And next, let's look at the policy proposal generation process, Basically, this is the process of the diffusion of policy ideas in professional circles and among the policy elites, especially bureaucrats, It involves, of course, academics, specialists, activists, and bureaucrats, The consensus building here is mostly a process of persuasion, You persuade the other side to accept your ideas, to reach a consensus. The problem for China is that it has yet to find a viable and all agreed upon policy proposal to address its tobacco epidemic. First of all, we know that the discourse on tobacco control through conferences, forums, media reports, circulation of papers have, thanks to the efforts of Professor Yang and others, have to some extent softened up the policy environment. But that, to be frank, it is still not adequate to coalesce around the consensus for need for significant change in China, right? I'm not going to explain that there for sake of time. And secondly, there are some cost-effective Best Buy technically feasible solutions available, right? We know that actually the study published by the Lancet magazine found that the accelerated implementation of the FCTC through tax increase, product labeling, advertising bans, and smoking restrictions would cost only 14 cents per person per year and would bring major change in China. But these measures are not congruent with the dominant values of the policy community in China, so they will not be selected out. Right? Again, Professor Dr. Li said, but the leaders believe that a strong tobacco control policy would be in direct conflict with the state's overall goal of economic development. Professor Yang also made the same point here. Right? And thirdly, well, this issue of the anticipation of future constraints. Basically, if you're making the decision, you're not going to push strongly for a proposal if you anticipate this future constraints like a public acceptability of that policy proposal. That is exactly the problem here in China's tobacco control, because smoking has become part of the culture in China. Right? People offer cigarettes because they believe it's an easy way to make a friend, solidify a bond, or ease an introduction, right? I have this, my personal experience. My father, several years ago, he visited the United States. He's a veteran smoker. He visited the United States. Well, of course, we didn't make any cigarettes available for him, so he had no choice but to quit the smoking. He stayed here and there, actually, for a couple of years, very healthy. But when he returned to China, he resumed smoking. So I asked him why. But his answer, if you are offered a cigarette and decline, you are seen as rude. Right? Well, that, I believe, not just himself, but every Chinese smoker would think that way, probably. Right? This may itself discourage the adoption of certain anti-smoking measures, effective anti-smoking measures. And for the Chinese leaders, because they already face legitimacy problems, they probably figure out why not bother, right, offending 350 million smokers, right, by restricting their freedom to smoke. Right? And finally, let's examine the political climate. Again, but this is the political process that includes the swings of national mood, power jockeying, changes of administration, and it involves the politicians, bureaucratic leaders, pressure groups, consensus building, which is different from the proposal generation, is actually built mostly by bargaining. In the words of Professor David Mike Lampton, this is like a plum for peach process, right? Totao baoli in Chinese. But political environment so far has not been right for government action in this area. Right? First, let's look at the bureaucratic politics. We know that Minister of Health is the primary central ministry championing tobacco control. But we also know that the Minister of Health is bureaucratic weak compared to the powerful Ministry of Industry and Information Industry, which has leadership relations with the State Tobacco Monopoly Administration, STMA. Right? A compromise between the two ministries, right, is very unlikely because they pursue totally different objectives here, right? The Minister of Health want to reduce consumption, production of tobacco, but the tobacco, the STMA, right, they want profit. They want to expand the production. Right? So this is like a day and a night, right? It's very hard to reconcile that difference and reach a compromise. And also, a compromise between the two is very unlikely because the Minister of Health doesn't have much to offer in the bargaining process, right? I've read a report that basically described how an official of the STMA basically accused a delegate to the FTA talks, which is how many ministers do I have? Oh, 5 minutes. That's more than enough. That official from STMA accused this delegate, right, in the FTA, the delegate is happened to be from Minister of Health. I think, is that you, Professor Yang? Yeah. Basically, she was accused of being traitorous. And that guy further said that you guys are civil service officials, right? And your salaries, one-tenth of your salaries actually come from us, right? So this is the actual vivid example how, you know, that there's really not much that the Minister of Health can offer, right, in this bargaining process, right? And secondly, let's look at the top elite politics. Right? Basically, there's a lack of incentives or skills of the top leaders to create this political climate for implementing more significant tobacco control measures. We know that, I just want to offer an example from India. Right? The Indian government seems to be very sophisticated in pushing for stricter the tobacco control measures. During the FCTC negotiations, they actually played a sophisticated, Robert Putnam would call a two-level game consisting of simultaneous and mutually reinforcing negotiations at both the domestic level and the international level. In 2003, for example, during the FCTC talks, the Indian cabinet approved the strong provisions of the tobacco control bills in parliament. And because of India's lead role in the FCTC negotiations, the parliament had no problem of passing that legislation, but that led to the Indian Tobacco Control Act in 2003. And that act, in turn, strengthened India's position at the negotiation table, pushing for a strong FCTC. But China could have done the same. Especially considering that the 2003 SARS, Professor Yang also said that in the presentation, right, the 2003 SARS actually opened a policy window to couple this 2003 FCTC negotiation with the post-SARS public health capacity building. But unfortunately, that even though China ratified the FCTC, that is very good, but as Wu Yicheng, another actually a very strong advocate of tobacco control, said that the top leaders, right, they don't have strong will in tobacco control. There's no expression of that strong will. Right? And since you might wonder whether now it has incentive. Of course not. Right? Since 2010, we know that the government has been preoccupied with playing this game of distribution of power. And then more recently, they were preoccupied with writing Bushelai's political obituary, right? So I think that probably their job has been done, right? That's good news. And so, if you look at, just examine the three streams, right, the problem has not been fully recognized as a problem. An all agreed upon policy proposal is not available. The politics is not receptive to stricter tobacco control. So, there's no progress, right? And how many Okay, it's time. So, maybe I will just stop here, but I was thinking of talking a little bit about the role of the policy entrepreneurs, people like Professor Yang, but obviously I don't have time, so I'm going to stop here, and thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Is this working? Everyone hear us? Thank you for coming. We now have a chance to talk with our panelists. In a minute, we're going to have two microphones that will be available for questions from the floor. If you plan to ask a question, please wait for the microphone to get to you and identify your name and your institution, and please keep your questions short so that we can get to as many of you as possible. Before we start, I'd just like to make a couple of points and start the conversation with our panelists. Something that is not obvious sometimes to people in the West is the effects of the one-child policy in China. So what we have often now in this generation of new parents is families where the mother and the father are each single children. And in that case, in many jurisdictions, they are allowed to have two children, if both parents are single children. So you have this couple, let's call them Mr. and Mrs. Wang, and they have their two kids, the two little kids. Now think about it, traditionally in Chinese culture, you care for your parents, right? So they have each two parents, and sometimes if their grandparents are alive, they may have, how many? Four grandparents each. So what you are thinking of is one couple, one working couple with 14 dependents, right? Now the retirement age in China is quite young. For women it's 55. Of course that doesn't mean women stop working after 55. But officially they can be asked to leave their post and lose their salary after 55. So you think about this family of 14 people, one working couple. What happens when this tidal wave of non-communicable disease caused by tobacco hits this family? What's going to happen to this family of two working people? So you think the devastating effect, first of all, the care for the person who is sick, because often that falls to the family. The medical costs, which can be devastating financially to the family, the loss of the contribution of the sick members of the family. For example, grandparents are often taking care of babies in China. You see that very common. So you can see that at the microeconomic level, the impact of this disease burden is very potentially devastating, and. It's also something that may not be accurately reflected in the numbers that the economists are seeing, because if you think about medical costs and how financially devastating they are at the micro level, at the larger level, remember that this is a kind of industry. In China, they're growing the medical sector, and what that means in many cases is that hospitals are borrowing money, they're taking loans out to build infrastructure, to build new hospital buildings and so forth. To pay off those loans, it's not the central government putting the money in, it's the hospitals borrowing the money from banks. To pay off those loans, they have to gain a profit from their market. And their market is sick people, right? Now, assuming that the people are not so sick that the labor force is drained, it's all good, right? I'm not saying it's good. but from an economist's perspective, this is mobilizing people's personal savings that they've been saving for a rainy day, such as when they get sick, mobilizing, taking that money out from under the mattress and going and spending it in the medical sector where it's going to pay off this capital infrastructure, it's generating jobs, it's boosting the GDP. So when we talk about the big medical costs, I'm wondering, are there people who see this maybe as a plus, who are seeing dollar signs in their eyes when we talk about these huge numbers, this huge burden of medical costs, and who are not seeing the effect on Mr. and Mrs. Wang? And they are not seeing that the future generation will miss out on the good schooling and so forth that this economically devastated family will be experiencing. So my question to you, and particularly I think to Dr. Huang, because I think you are very familiar with the health system, as the biggest experiment in health sector reform rolls out in China, as the government has more and more of a financial stake in health because of more widespread health insurance in China, do you think that the attitude to medical costs may change and that this may change the government's view of the burden of the tobacco epidemic in China? And please go ahead and answer.
Well, that is a excellent question. For the Chinese leaders themselves, they don't need to worry about healthcare cost, right? That is not personally not a problem to them. They have access to the best healthcare in China. Actually, there are some statistics that cannot be independently verified, but they basically say the majority of the healthcare funding basically is spent on those 8.5 million. Government officials, but we also know that even the dictators, right, they want to, no matter how, even though they are not accountable to the people, they still want to be liked, right? That explains why they are pushing for this idea of healthcare reform, spending billions of dollars on healthcare reform. And well, that is, I think, is a good thing. It's the positive change, although I would have to say that what the government claimed of so-called 95% coverage is a true lie. And in fact, 200 million migrant workers, right, obviously are still not covered, right, even though officially they are. This is going to become a problem, this skyrocketing healthcare cost, that is going to be a huge burden to the Chinese families. They say that by 2025, it's going to increase by 50% of the healthcare spending. But in the meantime, I figure out that there is a schizophrenic policy coming out. Basically, on the one hand, they say we need to control the healthcare cost, right, in China. That is not acceptable. But on the other hand, the people, the government officials, saying, the share of the healthcare spending as a percentage of the GDP is still very low. It's only 5.1%. The global average is 9%. So we still have a lot of room to improve in that regard. So I feel like this is a very schizophrenic policy, and I don't see how they could balance these two developments. Yeah.
Well, Well, I think that Sarah really raised a very, very important the issue that on the surface that Chinese government, you see the reason they want to promote the tobacco industry because this is somewhere between 7% to 10% of revenue, and even more than real estate or oil industry. So, put this, it's a very important industry. But on the other hand, you said so rightly, this is a penny wise pound foolish, because that really, you know, it's a reveal fundamental challenges beyond public health, you know, economically, socially, demographically, politically, internationally, name it. Now, here's the question is that Dr. Wang said repeatedly, I think you're right, that most leaders perceive this is a long-term challenge. You know, I only interested in short-term things, you know. But it's not really long-term, because China is in the midst of the major change. China will be hit both as a developing country, as a developer country to a certain extent, two levels of the healthcare crisis. On the one hand, you see the population is still poor, cannot afford basic health care. Second, on the other hand, it's the developer countries, you know, disease problem, diabetes, high blood pressure, so name it. At the same time, China's public health system is not adequate at all to deal with that. So public health issue emerged very, very rapidly as one of the top issues. That issue could immediately undermine the social political stability of the country, further, you know, reveal the fundamental crisis in terms of the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party. So I think if the leaders are smart, particularly upcoming leaders, they should realize they should do and do that now before too late.
Yes.
Professor Yang.
I agree with Professor Li. I think maybe the before, it's just is by individual people is pay medical fees, but now it's a change, a little change, and more is fee is by the government. So I think before it's the government didn't consider, maybe just it's the tobacco industry gave government revenue, but for the medical phase, just by the family member. But now it's changed. And it's more and more proportion is paid by government. So I think it's the conditions to push the government to change their attitude. And the second, it's the, I think it's some that messages is just it's lobbied by the tobacco industry. They think, oh, we give you the revenue. If you the stop, if you tobacco control, maybe they affect the tobacco income. But in fact, it's we have the 20 or 30 years to change the industry, because we have it's a lot of the smokers. They cannot they stop smoking in one day. So that's why it's, I think it's the Professor Huang said it's right. We haven't the long way to the persuade the top leader. So I think we should, it's from the policy and the political level to the persuade the leader.
Okay, I think we have about 20 minutes. So why don't we open the floor? If I think we have a microphone, we've got a question here. Got a question here? Could you identify yourself, please?
Okay. So first, I'm Qing Qing from an intern from here, Brookings Metropolitan Area Program. Thank you for all your wonderful speech. I totally agree. It's not only a public health problem, but also a social political problem. So right now, I'm concerned about a specific group, like the China's internal migrant workers. And also the children. So I'm wondering, do you have some specific concerns or research on the effort for that group? And the following question is, how do you think the international involvement or international organization will play in the bottom-up structure? Thank you.
Migrant workers, 在这方面有没有什么研究？就是 tobacco, can you affect them? 民工?
So, there are several the research is about the floating population. So first, maybe you can search some paper. It's developed for the woman. It's in the floating population. So generally in China, it's for the woman's smoking rates. It's very lower, almost just 2 or 3%. But for the floating population, maybe the 15 to 20. So that is we should pay more attention is for these areas.
Well, I wanted to answer the second part of your question about the international dimension. As we know that at least a sizable group of people in China or intellectual community, they're always critical about the foreign pressure. They think it's the deliberate effort to contain China, embarrass China, or make China, put China down, and etc. But they have difficulties to argue on this issue. Now, of course, some people accuse Professor Yang as a traitor or whatever. But that voice is very, very, insignificant in my view. The fact is that it's really China's own problem because only 2%, maybe even less than 2% cigarettes sold in China are from foreign countries. So that really tells you a lot. And also that most of the NGO or foreign foundations are really very friendly to China to support this cause. You see the Bill Gates Foundation, maybe it's of course the Bloomberg Foundation, they all take a very friendly approach to China. It's China's best interest to improve. Now, one thing I should also mention that Professor Yang, her campaign, the three older ladies campaign, really, again, so with respect, not the old ladies, the really remarkable, very courageous ladies. They designed the program in such a powerful way. They recruit some of the, left-wing intellectuals to this campaign. Some of the famous journalists or journalist professors usually always criticize the West, but they also think in that area, China's best interest to do that. So you really cannot blame foreigners. Anyone to argue that in China just as, really self-defeating if that kind of argument. So I think that one important thing is like a conference like this, we are very passionate about this because such an important issue. 1 million people die and 2 million people will die in matter of 8 every year. So nothing is more important than this kind of issue. It's China's best interest. The international community show our goodwill. We sometimes use harsh terms like dragon, the smoking dragon, or even sick man of Asia. But I just want to make him wake up a call.
That make me the enemy of the Minister of Health.
Okay, yeah. It's a really wake up a call to see that in that fundamentally important area, China should show its responsibility. China, Chinese government, particularly Ministry of Foreign Affairs, always say that China is a responsible stakeholder. China combines laws and norms. Now let's look at the 37.3 points. How to improve it? Improve it now.
May I just, well, it's also for the second question, just to follow up at Chen's. I think, even though we could say the Chinese regime is opaque, is authoritarian, right, the international actors, international players indeed have an important role to play in the process of agenda setting, policy formulation, and implementation. That we have seen that very clearly in China's setting of the HIV/AIDS agenda, right? I think the same could happen in the case of tobacco control. It's just that, first of all, I think the international actors, players, right, the movement, right, supporting Chinese tobacco control movement got to have their message as loud as possible, as clear as possible, and as consistent as possible. I think it's not their job to sing the present sounds to the Chinese leaders, praising them how great their job, is, I think that they could play a constructive role in this process. And secondly, I think they could help the Chinese civil society play a more significant role in Chinese tobacco control. Also, the three ladies, right? The Professor Yang, Xu Guihua, and Wei Qing. But they themselves, they feel like, you know, to quote Xu Guihua, she said she was like very pathetic. You know, it was like, you know, in her words, retired old ladies confronting huge tobacco industry alone. But that should not be the case, especially, but these are the people who are promoting a cause that is good for the Chinese people, right? That is good for the Chinese economy. I don't see why, but that they should fight in this cause all by themselves alone, right? You know, I was appalled when I saw that they said this China's largest anti-tobacco campaign. This move has only like 1,000 people with a budget of $61,000. Very small percent share is from the government. That shouldn't be the case. If the money can't be from the government, right, why not with the international community, right, support them, you know, making them financially viable? And make a big difference. Yeah.
I hope another lady can play an important role, the soon-to-be first lady, which we are really...
Michelle.
Not Michelle.
Well, actually Michelle is...
China's soon-to-be first lady, you already see the picture. That's actually, I want to applaud that very important, you know, appearance. I think that potentially can have a very strong impact. Certainly that her... You know, appearance is not just to represent herself, although she is one of the populist ladies in China, a great singer, but also her husband will be the head of the state in a matter of weeks. So I think that would be a turning point. Now, we talk about the leaders should use right policy to promote, to get popular. Now, this is a clear case. You will become popular, right? So I hope that the new leadership will take that position, take that opportunity.
Okay, thank you. Can we have a mic over here, please? Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Montserrat Meiro from the World Bank. If I understood you correctly, to our last presenter, by the way, thank you very much for a great presentation to three of you. Mr. Juan, you said despite the effort, and it's clear the effort and the capacity that exists in China to analyze and to make available all evidence necessary for a real, to put together a coherent political proposal. Despite all that effort, this hasn't happened, or all that effort is not yet sufficient, and the proposal that we have is not yet coherent. What's missing from that proposal in your view?
That, I think, Professor Yang would be in a better position to answer that question. What is missing from that proposal? You know, I do think there is the room for compromise between the two the sides. Well, again, well, even I use this metaphor of day and night, you know, one side is pushing for, you know, tobacco control, reducing production, you know, reducing consumption. The other side seems to be pushing, promoting the profit, production, and they have a strategy that Professor Yang also explained, this so-called lowering tar level and reducing harm. Well, that is, you know, that against the totally against the objective of the tobacco control. You know, while on the surface there seems to be no room for compromise, I do think it's necessary for them, you know, for the purpose of Chinese tobacco control, both sides sit down and negotiate and find a compromise, you know, and what is missing in Chinese tobacco industry, which I find very interesting, is that this deal, I haven't seen any tobacco manufacturers like trying to squeeze the share of their tobacco production and venture into other fields such as dairy industry, drinkers, you know, and other industries, which is happening in India, where the largest tobacco production firm is moving toward other industries. And I haven't seen that happening in China. Maybe Professor Yang could maybe have anything to add to this. What's the missing link here? Yeah.
I think that's for the tobacco control in China. In this stage, all its issue, most issue, it's just it's in the health circle. Maybe I think it's in the future. Maybe we can it's so link other other strategy. For example, corruption. That's it's the first topic in China. Of course, just like the Professor Huang said, it's the many officer, it's the lot of the officer, it's like to the got the cigarette. But it's other side, it's the corruption, it's very serious. So our government is pay more attention to the stop use the free cigarette. So I think, so we have other research said it's for the tobacco industry. This is the revenue. Not most, maybe the 50% is just for the other government department because they use the free cigarette. So before is we said for the medical fee, but now is for this, we just link the, against the corruption. And so it's in China, I think, so tobacco control should they link the different the areas for the medical reform, reform, and they link to the monopoly industry reform. And they link the other issue. So I think so it's tobacco control. Then it's in future, maybe it's progress.
We only know the tip of an iceberg, you know, in terms of corruption for tobacco industry. We know the sheer mysteries that Li Wei's case, but the Li Wei started with the tobacco industry. But most of the corruption is actually related with some other areas, not the tobacco per se. So in that area, they still need more, you know, work to reveal how that powerful monopolized industry linked to the corruption issues. I think it's fundamentally important. And also that some of the cigarettes are extremely expensive. It's ridiculously expensive in China, but used as a gift, you know. And but this is only small things, tiny bit things. We do not know much. You know, the nature, but whenever you see the monopoly, you see power, you see the state industrial proximity, there will be a corruption. So in that area, we need to do further investigation.
Yes, just a comment on that. Under the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, Article 5, the tobacco industry should not be able to influence tobacco control policy. So you could interpret that, what is clearly happening with the STMA, even on the delegations to the conference of the parties, is a form of corruption, you could say. Yeah. I think we had a hand over here, and let's have you next. First, this woman.
Hi, I'm Julie Schneider from the National Cancer Institute. I just was wondering whether there had been any lawsuits brought against tobacco companies within China, and if so, could you summarize them and their effect in this area?
Who would like to take that?
Yeah. Pa Yuan.
I think so because it's a lot I think it's normal, it's a case, but just a very small case for the NGO is have this for the suit tobacco industry, not very popular. And so general, so our it's courts, they don't accept this case.
No, I want to add an excellent question. Actually, one of my policy recommendations is to really just like what happened in the United States, that the sue that the you know major tobacco companies, making them really see it's very, very costly. I think we do need to do that in China as well. Now, one good thing is about their campaign, they also really target the lawyers and law firms But so far, still there's no major case caught attention nationwide. But I think this should be the area that these companies really should be accountable for selling cigarettes to children, because it's violating law, right? So, but there's no case. And some of the cases dropped through negotiation early stage. So that's an area I think that the campaign, also the government, should really work on that, particularly from Ministry of Health.
Sorry.
My name is Evan Bletcher. I'm from the American Cancer Society. One of the earlier questions involved asking about the role of the international community in tobacco control efforts in China. But what about China's role in the internationalization of their tobacco industry? So far, we haven't seen the Chinese state monopoly engaging in large-scale exportation of cigarette. And I know they export a lot of leaf, but not so much the large-scale exportation of cigarette, and not the creation of manufacturing facilities, for instance, in other parts of the developing world. And as we see China's geopolitical influence growing in its neighbors in Southeast Asia and as far afield as Africa, where there's sort of a race for resources. If we are really successful with tobacco control in China, how do we mitigate the risk of Chinese production just being shipped off for African consumption? In the same way as you note that female smoking is low in China, and that's a future risk. Smoking itself is low in Africa, prevalence generally. Is there a risk if we are too successful? I don't want to use that term, but what do we also have to do in thinking about mitigating the risks of China internationalizing its tobacco industry in the same way as it's internationalizing its manufacturing base in general?
It's an excellent question. Certainly, China has export. Yuxi Hongta Group actually had the factories in, I think, South America, in Africa, in Southeast Asia. But you're right, compared with other industry in the global stage, it's a tiny bit. Partly maybe China's own market is huge. Yeah. You can see this is major consumption. There's also room targeting women in China. And maybe that's one reason. The second reason is that they face some major competitors, in the international front, that could be also reason. But I do not know whether you have some other insights. Speaking, its export is still very small.
Yeah. I think it's Dr. Ali is right. While you could even United States buy the Chinese cigarettes from the Chinatown, right? But basically, the Chinese exports the tobacco products is not a major concern here. Well, I think it's primary reason, as Dr. Lee said, is that if they can just make the big bucks in the domestic market, they don't need to, they don't need to think about actually internationalizing. This is the same dynamics we found in the Chinese pharmaceutical sector. Actually, even though since the 1990s, the Chinese pharmaceutical firms have been encouraged to go out or go global, so far we haven't seen much progress in that regard, simply because domestic market is still huge. They couldn't meet their production needs.
But I think, we show you that the tobacco products, cigarettes, so increase so quickly, but it's we survey is for the prevalence of the smoking in China. It's a keep the balance, not increase a lot. So based on the public the data, only the 3% is the cigarette the export. But we calculate and we think maybe it's the more cigarettes go abroad. And we know it's the tobacco industry. They have the supply. It wants to go global. So but this data is not the public. So we just suspect maybe it's the more cigarettes go abroad.
I think we can take one more question. Who is it going to be? we've had one from the World Bank. So I'll give a turn to someone who's not with the World Bank.
Hi, my name is Alana Yuretsky. I teach at George Washington University. I have a question for you, Dr. Huang. I think it's really interesting that you have pointed out...
I'm the lightning rod.
I think it's interesting you pointed out the congruencies between the government's response to HIV/AIDS and the sort of lack of response to smoking. And, you know, if we look at HIV/AIDS as maybe the smallest public health problem, the largest political... commitment in China, right? The prevalence of HIV is very small versus smoking that has maybe, right, the largest public health, it's maybe one of the largest public health problems that has the smallest government commitment. You know, where did this commitment on HIV come from? I think we could argue that it came from sort of global influence, right? That it was, you know, that we look at global health, priorities and there's this trend of AIDS exceptionalism, right? So, you know, we could attribute it to maybe AIDS exceptionalism, maybe the fact that the international community looked at the HIV epidemic in China when it was first exploding on the front pages of our media as a human rights problem. And it saw a need to really pressure the Chinese government. So I'm wondering, where could that potential international pressure for a response to tobacco control come from, you know, on China?
Well, this is an excellent question indeed. Actually, if you look at the Chinese HIV/AIDS prevention and control, it is, again, a combination of the three streams, politics, policy proposals, and the problem identification. International society played a crucial role in helping China recognize there is indeed a problem. They also helped make the policy solution available to the Chinese leaders. And the political environment was receptive because at that time, Dr. Li actually knows better than I on this, the fourth generation leader was about to take over. That was 2002, 2003. They had actually, the new leaders want to strike a new theme, a theme different from their predecessors, you know, and then all these themes actually coupled in 2002-2003 with the SARS outbreak, you know. So you have to have a policy window open for that crucial change, you know. And so in this case of tobacco control, I think we need to wait for the next policy window open. We already, actually China, I think already missed two policy windows. The first is the 2003 SARS. The second is the 2011, last year, the UN special meeting on NCDs, the non-communicable diseases, because the tobacco related death actually accounted for a huge percentage of the NCD death that could be coupled to actually push for stricter enforcement of the FCTC, but that didn't happen. In fact, at that time, I was asked by the People's Daily to write something on this issue of NCD. I wrote something. Actually, I was not good at writing in Chinese, but I wrote it anyway. But then it didn't come out. Ask why. Well, the answer is this topic is not big enough. I said, come on, we're talking about NCD contributing to 85% of the mortality in China. You think that topic is not big enough? Well, that policy window is quickly, I think, is going to be closed quickly. So now we have to wait for the third policy window to open. That probably will happen after the people's the 18th Party Congress. Later this month, next month.
Yeah. Anything to add? No. Well, John, please.